content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is entitled, Climate Change Comes for Baseball, by Ellen Cushing. It happened fast. Almost as soon as Hurricane Milton bore down on South Florida last month, high winds began shredding the roof of Tropicana Field, home for 26 years to the Tampa Bay Rays baseball team. Gigantic segments of Teflon-coated fiberglass flapped in the wind, then sheared off entirely. In the end, it took only a few hours for the Trop to lose most of its roof, a roof that was built to withstand high winds, a roof that was necessary because it exists in a place where people can no longer sit outside in the summer, a roof that was supposed to be the solution. The problem, of course, is the weather. Of America's four major professional sports, baseball is uniquely vulnerable to climate change in that it is typically played outside, often during the day, for a long, unrelenting season, six games a week per team from March to October, which incidentally is when the Northern Hemisphere gets steamy and unpredictable, more so every year. In 1869, when the first professional baseball club was formed, the average July temperature in New York City's Central Park was 72.8 degrees. In 2023, it was 79. By 2100, it could be as much as 13.5 degrees hotter, according to recent projections. Hot enough to make sitting in the sunshine for a few hours unpleasant at best and hazardous at worst. In June, four Kansas City Royals fans were hospitalized for heat illness during an afternoon home game. On a muggy day four seasons ago, Los Angeles Angels starting pitcher Dylan Bundy began sweating so much you could see it on TV. He then took a dainty puke behind the mound and exited the game with heat exhaustion. Games have been moved because wildfire smoke on the West Coast and delayed because of catastrophic flooding in New York. What we used to call generational storms now come nearly every year. 2 weeks before the Trop's roof came off, a different storm ripped through Atlanta, postponing a highly consequential Mets-Braves matchup and extending the season by a day. Climate change is already affecting some basic material realities of the sport. Some ball clubs have added misting fans and massive ice water containers for temporary relief, making the experience of going to the game feel a little less like relaxing and a little more like surviving. A 2021 study found that umpires are more prone to mistaken calls in extreme heat, and one from last year found that decreased air density, the result of hotter temperatures, is changing the fundamental physics of how balls fly through the air. Baseball just saw its latest season come and go with the LA Dodgers, who play in a city that already experiences extreme storms, deadly heat, and drought, taking the World Series in five games. As we look forward to the next season and the one after that, the biggest question isn't whether Shohei Ohtani's new elbow can make him the greatest player in history, possibly, or whether sports betting has ruined baseball, quite possibly, or whether the Mets will go the distance in 2025, definitely. It's whether the sport will be able to adapt in time to save itself. It's becoming difficult for me as somebody who enjoys the sport and as somebody who researches climate change, Jessica Murphy, an assistant professor of sport administration at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, told me, I don't know that there's a way to have it all. In a scene from the movie Interstellar, the film's protagonist, a pilot named Joseph Cooper, takes his children and father-in-law to a baseball game in the blight-ravaged, storm-battered year 2067. A few dozen people are sitting in the stands of a dinky diamond that looks like it could belong to a high school team, eating popcorn. Cooper's father-in-law is grousing about how, in his day, we had real ballplayers, Who are these bums? And then one such bum turns around to reveal his jersey, and there's the joke, if you want to call it that. These are the New York Yankees. Timothy Callison shows this clip to his students he teaches at Florida State University's Department of Sports Management. That's the future of sport in the long run, he told me. The most powerful franchise in the history of baseball could become a traveling oddity. From a Yankees fan's perspective, from a baseball fan's perspective, that's a very troubling future. Murphy was even more direct. I do think sport might be one of the first things to go when we really move past these alarming tipping points about climate. Baseball has long been defined and enriched by its openness to the world. It gets better air in our lungs and allows us to leave our close rooms, as Walt Whitman wrote in 1846, during the sport's earliest days. It is the only major sport in which the point is for the ball to leave the field of play. Once in a while, on a lucky night in an open park, a home run lands in the parking lot or a nearby body of water. Wind, temperature, and precipitation are such a part of the game that the website FanGraphics includes weather in its suite of advanced statistics. The season begins in spring and ends in autumn, in a cycle that binds the sport to all living things. Renewal and decay, renewal and decay. Playing baseball in the fall has a certain smell. Oliver Noe, a Mets fan and philosophy professor at UC Berkeley, told me, playing baseball in the spring, in the hot summer, has a certain feel. In his book, The Summer Game, the famed baseball chronicler Roger Angel wrote of the flight of pigeons flashing out of the barn shadow of the upper stands, of the heat of the sun-warmed iron coming through your shirt sleeve under your elbow, of the moon rising out of the scoreboard like a spongy day-old orange balloon. Angel was writing in 1964 in the context of the closure of the Polo Grounds, the bony, misshapen old playground that was home to both the Mets and the Yankees at various times. He mourned the future of the sport when our surroundings become more undistinguished and indistinguishable. The next year, baseball's first indoor stadium, the Houston Astrodome, opened, the argument being that a roof was the only way to play baseball in the subtropical Texas climate. 60 years later, Houston is much hotter, and 8 teams, including the Rays, who are still trying to figure out where to play next season, have roofs. This includes 2 of the 3 newest parks in baseball in Miami and the Dallas metro area. The next new one in Las Vegas, which is one of the fastest warming cities in the country, will have one too. Most of these roofs are retractable, but in practice may tend to stay closed during summer's high heat and heavy rains. During any given week of the season, several games are played on plastic grass in a breezeless hangar, not under sky, but steel. In the future, the aesthetics of the game, the feel of the game, will be so different. If you're sitting in a sort of neutral, sanitized, protected space, Noe said, there won't be birds, there won't be clouds, there won't be glare from the sun, there won't be wind, there won't be rain, there won't be pollution. There won't be the sound of overflying airplanes. You'll be playing baseball in a shopping mall. This vision is, to be clear, the best answer we have so far to baseball's climate problem. If anything, it's actually too ambitious, too far off. Renovating existing parks to add roofs is impractical and expensive. Building new ones costs even more. We're not talking about one business and relocating it to a different building higher up in the land, Callison said. These are billion-dollar stadiums. They're intended to be permanent. Baseball is also invested in its own iconography. In cities such as Boston and Chicago, places with famous century-old open parks, domes will be a tough sell. And obviously they're not a perfect solution to extreme weather. In Phoenix, a city that had 113 straight 100-degree or more days this summer, the air conditioning system at Chase Field has been straining. Players have left games due to cramps, blaming the heat. Even if teams find the money and the will to build new parks, And even if those parks do the thing they're supposed to do, they might not do it fast or well enough to make baseball comfortable or safe enough to keep its fans, fans whom baseball is already anxious to retain, as other entertainment becomes more popular. Callison is pretty optimistic about some adaptation being possible, precisely because baseball, like all sports, is so dependent on its fans. People pay lots of money to be in baseball stadiums, about $3.3 billion in 2023, according to one analysis. Owners in the league have a major incentive to keep them coming. These are very wealthy and successful business leaders who aren't just going to let a product like this go away with such a financial stake in it, he said. Aileen McManimum, a sports management consultant and board member of the trade association Green Sports Alliance, told me that Major League Baseball does recognize that examining its relationship to the environment is fundamental to its continued existence. But MLB isn't a monolith. It's a multi-billion-dollar organization composed of 30 teams with 30 ownership groups in 27 cities across two countries. Callison doesn't believe that MLB is thinking as ambitiously or formally as it should be about the climate change's effect on the sport, and neither does Murphy. There really is no excuse to say this is a once-in-a-lifetime thing, a freak accident, Murphy said. The league and its organizations do have a responsibility to be forward-thinking and protect their people and their organizations from something that scientists have been waving their hands in the air about for a long time. Experts have all kinds of proposals, both radical and subtle, to go with along with the domes. Brad Wilkins, the director of the University of Oregon's Performance Research Laboratory, suggested making changes to the uniforms, which are polyester, highly insulative, and not very good at dissipating heat. The league did change the uniform slightly this year, in part to incorporate more breathable fabric, but many players found the quality lacking. McManimum talked with me about being more strategic regarding where and how we build new stadiums, looking for sites with natural ventilation and better shade, and using novel materials. She also suggested shortening the season to make it a little gentler on fans and players. Murphy, meanwhile, has argued for shifting the timing of the season and for opportunistically moving games based on weather, making baseball less tied to place. Not all of these ideas are immediately feasible, and none will be popular. All sports like to mythologize themselves, but baseball, this young country's oldest game, might have one of the most powerful and pernicious myth-making apparatuses of all. It's the stuff of poetry, of 18-hour documentaries, of love stories. Baseball people are intensely nostalgic. They love to find ways to be cranky about changes much less consequential than those. But Murphy's a fan and a pragmatist. If we dig our heels into the status quo, we will lose out on the things that we enjoy, she said. If baseball is to remain America's favorite pastime, we have no choice but to be flexible. Fans, players, and Major League Baseball think of the sport as something static, but in fact it is changing all the time. The earliest baseball games were played by amateurs on irregularly shaped fields with inconsistent rules and balls that were made of melted shoes wrapped in yarn and pitched underhand. Since then, we have seen, among other things, the introduction of racial integration, night games, free agency, the designated hitter, instant replay, sabermetrics, and the pitch clock, each new development greeted with skepticism and outrage, and then eventually acceptance. Now we face the most radical changes of all. Eventually, baseball, the sport of sun-baked afternoons, a sport made beautiful and strange by its exposure to the elements, may be unrecognizable. This will be the best-case scenario, because the alternative is that baseball doesn't exist. Our second story, Americans Are Hoarding Their Friends, by Faith Hill. Hypothetically, introducing friends from different social circles shouldn't be that hard. Two people you like, and who like you, probably have some things in common. If they like each other, you'll have done them a service by connecting them. And then you can all hang out together. Fun. Or if you're like me, you've heard a little voice in your head whispering, not fun. What if you're sweet with one friend and sardonic with another, and you don't know who to be when you're all in the same room? Or what if they don't get along? Worst of all, what if they do, but better than they do with you? What if they leave you behind forever, friendless and alone? That might sound paranoid, but in my defense, it turns out that these thoughts are common. Danielle Bayard Jackson, the author of Fighting for Our Friendships, The Science and Art of Conflict and Connection in Women's Relationships, told me that when she was a high school teacher years ago, she'd often hear students airing anxieties. So-and-so's befriending my friend, or I think she's trying to take her. She assumed it was a teenage issue until she began working as a friendship coach and found that her charismatic, high-achieving, successful adult clients didn't want to introduce friends either. The subject has been popping up online, too. A whole category of TikToks seem to consist of people just looking stressed, with a caption like, "When your birthday is coming up and you gotta decide if you want to mix the friend groups or not," or "Point of view mixing friend groups," and they're about to watch you switch between personality 1 and 3. In a recent Slate article, the writer Jason Gordon confessed to an overwhelming horror at merging friend groups. Linking friends scary, insecurity, envy, and instinct to hold tight to the people you love isn't new. It's fundamentally human. But keeping your friends to yourself, what I call friend hoarding, is a modern practice. Before the Industrial Revolution, having different social circles was hardly possible. You were likely to eat, work, and pray with the same people day in and day out. Only once more people moved from close-knit farming villages to larger towns and cities did strangers begin coexisting in private bubbles and forming disconnected groups. Today, this phenomenon has gone into hyperdrive, Catherine Stovoy, University of Washington sociologist, told me. With the internet and faster transportation, people can more easily maintain relationships from different parts of life. The more discrete the groups are, the harder it might be to integrate them. But the thing is, many people want to benefit from the kinds of introductions they're nervous to make. And ironically, though they might hoard friends out of fear of being abandoned, doing so could leave them more lonely in the end. Marissa G. Franco, the author of Platonic, How Understanding Your Attachment Style Can Help You Make and Keep Friends, told me that people who have plenty of individual friends can still experience collective loneliness or a yearning to be part of a group with common identity and purpose, something that a more connected, cohesive network could solve. Bayard Jackson mentioned something similar. "I've had people say to me how hungry they are to be a part of a friend group. This family feel," she says. And then in the same breath, they tell me they don't want to introduce their friends to one another. And I'll point out, do you understand how that doesn't work? If Americans let their friends mingle, they might form communities they've been hoping for. But first, they need to stop standing in their own way. Before the 18th century, most relationships were either familial or, at least some degree, practical. They were rarely about just having fun or developing intimacy, as friendship is usually conceived of now. But after industrialization, people suddenly had far more options in life. What they'd do for work, where they'd live, whom they'd meet. As Reuben Thomas, a University of New Mexico sociologist, told me, it became possible to be the only person who works as a hospital technician, but is also in a Sherlock Holmes book club, and is also in a rock climbing club, who goes to Renaissance fairs, and is part of a Swedish Lutheran church and lives in Wichita. Each pocket of life can yield more pals. These days, people can socialize online with scattered friends who will never end up at the same bar or party, and who might not even know of one another's existence. Even if friends live in the same area today, there are fewer so-called third spaces, free public areas where big groups can hang out. Just as romance has become privatized, with more people dating strangers from apps than acquaintances from their network, researchers told me that there's been a shift toward privatized friendship, too. Everybody has to have a play date rather than just going into the neighborhood and playing with whoever's there, Stovall said. Keeping friends separate can have benefits. It allows people to freely express certain sides of themselves in the safety of simpatico groups. Say earnest geekiness with the Renaissance stands, and adventurousness with the climbers. Stovall told me that this can be particularly important for young adults who might be trying on personas to figure out who they are. A more primal motivation also keeps many folks from making introductions. They're nervous that their friends will grow close and that they'll be cast aside. People have argued for decades that feeling threatened by friends' other bonds is immature, or worse, that it reveals how capitalism has crept into relationships, driving us to compete, amass power, and treat one another like possessions. Jamie Krems, a UCLA psychologist who studies friendship envy, told me, "But the cold, hard fact, I'm sorry to report, is that friendship inherently does involve some competition. According to the alliance theory, humans have evolved to make friends because they're in our corner, not someone else's, in times of trouble, and we're in theirs in return. Today, too, everyone has limited time, attention, and resources to share with the people they love, and more time with one person inevitably means less time with another. Friendship envy is adaptive," Krems told me. You can lose friends after introducing them. Researchers have found that friend poaching is a very real phenomenon. But even if that worst-case scenario isn't likely to happen, the thought of losing any closeness can be terrible. Boehner Jackson said that women in particular really value feeling like we're in this mutually exclusive private vault with our besties. It's cozy in there. And so many people already have a gnawing fear, she told me, that I'll be left behind, forgotten, that I don't offer anything interesting enough. Being the person who introduces two friends, Stovall called these people the catalyst brokers, nearly always involves some risk. Initially, the broker gains power because the two people she's introduced are dependent on her for access. The friends are also, hopefully, grateful for the connection. At some point, though, the broker might become redundant, even disposable, the same way a matchmaker or a real estate agent would be after a job well done. People may have more to gain than they do to lose when mixing friends, though. Making those introductions might make you feel more whole, like the various versions of yourself are finally coming together. Combining circles could be the difference between sustaining friendships and letting them languish from neglect. Given that finding time is a big obstacle in friendship today, your friends may also be able to offer you more support together than they could individually, especially in a crisis. They can work together to care for you. And you might start feeling like part of something larger than yourself, a remedy for the collective loneliness that Franco described. Drawing connections among people could even shift society as a whole, making it more equitable and less homogeneous. For one thing, friend hoarding, however unintentionally, can lead to opportunity hoarding, in which privileged people circulate resources among themselves rather than distributing them to people with greater need outside their bubble. And if people all stay locked in the groups they formed from, say, high school, society is more likely to remain stubbornly segregated. The German philosopher and sociologist Georg Simmel believed that a society with separate but overlapping circles allows people to observe one another's commonalities and differences, which, Stovall said, can breed empathy, understanding, tolerance, and a richness of experience and curiosity. It's a sign, she said, of a strong social fabric. This doesn't mean that everybody needs to immediately invite all their buddies to the same place and keep the door locked until they're ready to emerge as one megagroup. But maybe more people could start warming to the idea of being the broker, Maynard Jackson likes to remind people that friendships ebb and flow. Even if some of your friends do eventually get closer to one another than they are to you, that hierarchy isn't static. And it might help to remember, too, that the reason this all can feel so hard is that friends mean so much. Krems believes that friend envy is functional in part because it motivates people to care for their relationships, to not take them for granted. In her research, she's found that when people feel that their bond is threatened, they'll take pains to protect it. This might involve telling a friend that you care about them, so much so that you fear them getting close to someone else, even if you know that reaction might seem silly. The reason that you probably can't keep your friends separate, even if you want to, you certainly can't dictate whom they connect with. That's the thing about friends. They're not characters in your head, but autonomous human beings with their own motivations and experiences. That's why they're interesting and why they give us so much to lose. Next, How Can I Find More Satisfaction in Work? By James Parker. This is a Dear James reader's existential worry. Dear James, what are we modern humans to make of work? How can I do it without so much anxiety but still sufficient productivity? The daily grind is mostly fine but also highly stressful, with manic bouts of propulsion towards deadlines, little clarity around what I should do or should have done, and the constant drumbeat of fear that I'm not adding much value. I find myself regularly reviewing awkward and painful moments of my day at night, when I should be sleeping. I've never been able to settle on an overarching mission for my working life because nothing seems reliable or worthy enough of sacrificing the other major factors that impact my happiness, mostly the amount of time I can spend with my family, the location where I live, the security of a decent salary. So in a way, I see myself as infinitely flexible. I don't have a great deep reason for doing what I do now, but it would probably take a lot for me to tack to something else. I have no grand plan. Am I going to regret this when I reach retirement age? Is it just this job or just what the work is? Is it me? What can the average person expect from a lifetime of work? What should we be aiming for? Dear reader, in my 20s, I worked in an office in West London analyzing transport statistics. How many cars are on the rotary at one time and which direction they're coming from? How many passengers climb on the train at a particular station, etc.? I made projections. I stared at graphs. And before I was driven from the place by a detonation sequence of mind-wrecking panic attacks, I was strangely happy there. The boringness of the work seemed to have its own value, a feeling of muffled industry, engrossing in a gentle, overcast way. No mistaking it for something that might ignite my spirit. It was work, nothing but. Not every job has to blaze with vocational intensity. Not everybody needs to have a fulfilling career. And I can assure you that you are adding ineffable value to your workplace just by being there. An office is a mystical body like any other, and one person's presence or absence changes everything. So do your work, and then go home. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org.